It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly Podcast. England secured a quietly impressive series win over Bangladesh this week as they look to nail down their squad for the ODI World Cup later this year. The Women's Premier League has started off with a bang in India, and Shaheen Afridi has reinvented himself as a number six in the PSL, which continues to thrill. We will also be trying to make sense of the CDC hearing into the Yorkshire racism scandal. I'm Yaz Rana, and with me this morning is Katia Whitney, Ben Gardner and Phil Walker. It has just stopped snowing here at the Oval with the first game of the County Championship less than a month away. Not long to go, folks. Let's start with that series in Bangladesh. Ben, followers of English cricket might not appreciate this because of England's excellent record there, but winning an ODI series in Bangladesh is not to be sniffed at.
Yeah, in a way, it's almost a good thing for England, or at least their reputation among you know, people watching, that they lost the last game in the manner they did. It's just a reminder that Bangladesh are quite good at cricket and that winning there is not an easy thing to do. And equally, I think Bangladesh will be quite disappointed looking back at those first two games that they didn't put up a better showing. I mean, what, since 2015 World Cup, the only two sides to have won there are England sides captained by Jos Buttler, and that includes India going there twice, a weakened India earlier this year, but also this was a weakened England side. So yeah, it is a good win, and also checked kind of the right boxes, I guess. You had Quicks, who, you know, sort of coming back into the frame, kind of bowling well. You had two batters who needed to shore up their places in that squad, doing so with excellent hundreds. And yeah, just from, you know, it wasn't very long ago that we were looking at England's ODI side thinking like the World Cup preparations was kind of hard to work out what the final squad would boil down to. There were loads of players in the frame that they weren't that sure of their first 11, that is Stokes going to retire, all that sort of thing. It's slowly coming into focus, I think. The squad, at least. The 11 is still quite hard to work out, I think. And I guess we'll talk about that a bit more. But their World Cup preparations are going quite well, I guess. Which is good because, you know, they're basically over. I mean, by the time that they play their next ODIs, I think they'll have named their provisional squad for the World Cup. So
yeah, I mean, it's the first time that Mark Wood and Jofra Archer have played together in pretty much 2 years, which is obviously exciting.
Is it a squad of 15?
Yeah.
So what, 13 pretty much nailed down, you would think?
Yeah, pretty much. So Bairstow, Milan, Roy, Root, Brooke, Butler, Livingston, Moeen, Archer, Wood, Curran, Wokes, Rashid are the 13 that I think people are assuming, okay, if fit, will go.
And then the other two, probably another Quick and a top order batting option, but I've also seen suggestions it could be two bowlers. I think I would like to see that there isn't really another top order batting option in that squad at the moment, right? If you look at top five options, you can push Butler to five and then have Livingston or Moeen at number six. So I guess, but it's tricky because England likes having an all-rounder. That's the thing about the 11. Like, there's quite a lot of players you think like, oh, they kind of have to play, and actually when you get to it, it's like, where do they all fit in? Like, you look at Bairstow, obviously the opening partnership, Root is Joe Root. Milan is, you know, England's form ODI batter. Brooke is, you know, the form batter in world cricket. Joss Butler is Joss Butler. But then you...
You can't play all of them.
Exactly, because...
And that's even before you get Stokes back.
Yeah, exactly. And England want an all-rounder in the top six, so that's quite tricky. You'd probably say Milan might be the unfortunate one to miss out, or he goes up to open. There are questions over the 11, but kind of good questions, I suppose. It's more, how do we fit in all our very good players, rather than we don't really know how to...
If you were going to pick the team now, and you were looking at, you know, 7 or 8 games on those pitches, some of which will be flat, some of which will be challenging, would you prefer, assuming that Bairstow's a lock as an opener, as he should be, do you go with Milan or do you go with Roy?
I think they've probably got similar problems. There's a stat about Milan that I found out today that after Bangladesh, he now has more hundreds than he does 50s, but more ducks than he does 100s in ODI cricket. And I think you can see similar problems with Roy and him being back in form, but also the consistency problems. I think they will go with Roy. I would probably go with Milan, given the form he's been in and the kind of prolonged form he's been in rather than Roy's recent form. But it's, you know, can you drop Jason Roy, really?
Is it worth dwelling as well on the merits of the 200s? Probably shouldn't read too much into two individual innings, but it does show, I think, the different strength the two have. Milan's was a sort of a brilliant innings in terms of innings construction, understanding a situation. And that's the thing about Milan, is he just knows how to make runs. I mean, that's what comes with making, so with having all that experience with making, you know, 10,000 first class runs, you will have faced a variety of situations, a variety of conditions, and your livelihood is on making runs more often than you don't, essentially. And that is what Milan is very, very good at. And there had been questions about him in spinning conditions, and he in a way overcame them. And this was a match winning innings. This was better than the Roy's innings, I would say, overall. But it also, the thing with Roy's innings is that it was like kind of classic Jason Roy, but with a sort of a twist that he played spin very well. But it was still sort of that kind of proactive, scoring at nearly a run a ball, playing those, adding sweeps and reverse sweeps, kind of taking the game to Bangladesh. So I think you kind of saw the two strengths of either player in there. I guess from what Matthew Mott has said, that might lean possibly into Milan's favour, and that they recognise that the tracks won't all be belters at the World Cup, that you have to win on a variety of surfaces, that it's maybe about sort of toning down that aggression somewhat, as they kind of had to do a little bit at the end of the 2019 World Cup as well. So that might speak in Milan's favour, but yeah, that'll be really close. But equally, there's so much that could change between now and then in terms of injury, a little bit in terms of form, like if someone goes through the summer is really struggling, that could come into it. Or if someone, you know, this time last year we wouldn't have said Harry Brooke would be that close to the England World Cup squad, and now we're kind of thinking he's a lock. Could a similar kind of thing happen? Could they kind of pick someone for the ODI series who isn't in the World Cup squad and they have a stormer and that comes into play, someone like Will Jacks? I don't know.
Well, it's like you said, it depends what they want from opening partnership, right? And England's ODI batting dominance has been built off that ultra aggressive opening partnership with Roy and Bairstow. But A, like you said, will that work in Bangladesh? And B, is that opening partnership the same as it was before 2019, in the build up to 2019, when they were so dominant? We don't know what Bairstow's going to be like when he comes back. We don't know how Roy's form's going to hold up, even with these 200s. And like you said, Milan's 100 was better than Roy's 100. So a change of approach might work better in terms of the pitches in India and in terms of where England are at right now as an ODI batting unit compared to where they were 4 years ago.
It's a weird one, the comparison to 2019, because I think that the squad depth is actually better now than it was 4 years ago. Like, if you're looking at the squad and who might not get into the squad, you've got those 13, and then if you only have one more quick ahead of that, someone like Ollie Stone, Reece Topley or Saqib Mahmood isn't making, potentially two of those three don't make the squad.
And then you've got Billings, Hales, Salt,
Duckett.
Vince, Duckett, lots of good players who would earn their stripes at that level in a World Cup, but probably won't make the cut. So you're absolutely right. The strength and depth in the 50-over side is terrifying, really. Personally, I was really pleased for Milan because he occupies a peculiar position in English cricket. He's a bit of an enigma. He's never fully become ensconced in any of the formats, but he's never done badly in any of them, and he's often done very well in a number of them, right? He's got 4 tons in 18 games in ODIs, albeit he's also got a few blobs, as you say, cash out. In T20 internationals, at one point he was number one in the world, but the rankings were spurious, and so that was sort of held against him almost. But even so, you know, I mean, his numbers are still very impressive. Also, strike rate in ODI cricket as well. You know, he's going basically at a run of ball, 93 and a bit. And Test cricket, you know, he made an Ashes 100. So he's always done okay. But I think he's been conscious of his place slightly in the kitchen at the party. And that innings was probably, albeit in quite a low profile game of cricket in truth, that was probably his most dominant one-man performance for England. And he said that afterwards, that, you know, that was probably one of his best ever days out as a cricketer, because he dominated that innings, and without him they'd have fallen over like a pack of cards.
Just on his winter, England have had three ODI series that have been quite hard to really pay attention to. His Bangladesh series happened, what, 28 hours after the Test match in New Zealand, one of the best Test matches of all time. In the Australia series happened 5 minutes after England won the World Cup. And the South Africa series was a rearranged series from ages ago. So three series that no one really wanted to play. Some of the players literally said that with the Australia series. Milan has got his head down. He's got big hundreds in all three of those series. And kind of like how he forced his way into the T20 side when he wasn't really supposed to be in that either. He's just demanded selection.
And also he could have gone and taken money elsewhere, presumably, right? You know, no one knocks Alex Hales for deciding against touring and playing in these games. Because there was money to be made elsewhere. And, you know, we live in the new pragmatism and everyone accepts that. But David Milan, he's always there. He's always totally devoted to his hopes of one day being fully accepted as a part of this England side. Personally, I've really grown to like him a lot as a player in recent years and as a bloke as well. And he's almost certainly paid his way into that squad now and you know, it'll come down to form. Jason Roy is a world beater on his day. The question is how many days he will have across 9 or 10 games. But at the moment, I'd have an inkling for Milan to open, assuming that Bairstow does come back fully fit and so on.
Yeah, I think it's so difficult. I mean,
it is difficult.
The one thing that we haven't really talked about yet is when you get to the makeup of the 11, there's one guy who, if Stokes isn't back, who hasn't played recently, is kind of assumed to be in that 11, is Liam Livingstone. And Liam Livingstone at 6 and Moeen Ali at 7, or the other way around, didn't really work for England in the summer. Those are two guys who are destructive white ball players who earn big, big money in the IPL, widely regarded as two of the best T20 players in the world. But I think there are serious question marks around them as ODI top 6 players, and one of them has to bat 6 without Stokes in the 11. And that, especially on the pitches you're likely to get in India, I do just think that looks quite a vulnerable side. You compare that whoever bats at 6 there to 2019, where you had Joss Butler at 6. I'd looked at the India team that won in 2011 in India. You had Dhoni, Yuvraj and Rayner as your 5, 6, 7, and they'd rotate that depending on match situation, etc. That's quite a big difference what England have there. And that
I 100% agree with you there, right? And Moeen Ali, for all that I adore him, in the real clutch moments, I'm not sure he's the sort of cricketer that you absolutely rely on when the pressure is through the roof. Liam Livingstone's still getting going, and he's a maverick, and he's an outlier of a cricketer in every way, and that's what makes him so interesting. But there's very scant evidence that he's kind of a cold-blooded killer at the end of an innings. Butler, you want to bat him at 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 and 6. Of course you do. But I wonder if, looking at it now, he might even revert down a place or two into the Dhoni position, possibly even as a floater, but possibly in that number 6 position as the person that you're going to rely on when push really does come to shove. And I can see the logic of breaking up. If they're both in the first 11, and especially on Indian pitches, you'd expect they would be breaking up Livingstone and Mo and having Butler in there in the middle between them.
But then the difficulty is, if Stokes comes back, then you lose your third spin option that England also want to have. So there's kind of like no simple way around it.
Yeah, I think the fact that England are looking more and more secure and like they have more of a squad nailed down, for me, I think makes it less likely that Stokes will come back.
Yeah.
That felt to me like it would be almost like if England desperately needed him and the team didn't really make sense without him. I mean, obviously, yeah, there are going to be issues with the 11, but it's not going to be the same as saying, like, you know, putting up the bat signal and saying, Stokes, we need you.
So I don't think he'll come back. I think it's too obvious for him to come back. So I just don't think he'll do it.
What do you think about that? He's on one knee. He's going off to the IPL. The Ash isn't far away. We're worried about the state of the knee, and then he might miss a World Cup.
The IPL thing is tricky. It's a tricky one. He knows his body better than we do. He has not bowled himself as a captain when he's been perfectly able to, and he did that last summer. So we don't know exactly where he is at. I think he's grown up enough to recognise that he picks up his IPL contract and he's still useful in the side, fielding at deep mid wicket and coming off every four or five times with the bat, number five, or even opening maybe, who knows? He's done all the different options in the IPL and not bowling a ball. I think he will. He has such autonomy over everything in cricket that he may well not bowl a delivery during the whole of the IPL, play for 3 hours every 3 or 4 days, and then he'll be fine. I think we've got to trust him to be sensible here, and I hope that's the case. Certainly, if he turns up crocked for the Ashes, having, you know, given it his all for whichever IPL franchise he's playing for this time round, then it starts to look very empty. But I think he's balanced these balls for so many years now, and he's always had problems with his knee. So I don't envision it being that big a problem.
And he's also talked about prioritising the build-up to the Test summer, regardless of how well his franchise
does. So he'll be coming home early. He'll be preparing for that Ireland Test match. I don't see it being that big a deal. But then, look, if he goes over on his knee in the first week, then it starts to look a little bit hollow. But I don't envision that happening.
I think the main point is, like, England need Ben Stokes a hell of a lot more than Ben Stokes needs England, right? And as soon as you try and control a character like Ben Stokes, then that's when you're going to lose him. So you kind of have to, you know, he's big enough and old enough that you have to trust him to get on with it. And if he doesn't, well, then maybe, yeah, you do have a conversation. But if he can walk, he's playing for England, right? So I don't think it's that much of a problem, really. I think it's kind of overblown. And this whole thing of sport is inequality, it's absolutely not an inequality. You know, Ben Stokes is better than everyone else. So Ben Stokes kind of gets to do what he wants.
Mm. And it's not just England, it's ODI cricket and the ICC World Cup need Stokes more than Stokes needs.
Yeah, exactly. Them. Exactly. Yeah. You've got, like, it's all about brand and all that kind of stuff. And as long as he can walk out on the field, he's going to walk out on the field and he's going to do something amazing because he's Ben Stokes. The fact that he's playing in the IPL and may or may not hurt his knee while doing so doesn't really change that, to be honest.
Yeah, I would imagine, look, if Rob Key had the choice and there was no consequences to it, then he'd probably say, come home and convalesce for a few weeks, Ben. But those days are long, long gone. And nobody is, as Catchy says, no one is going to look him in the eye and say you can't do this, because he is the emperor.
Just going back to the makeup of the England ODI side, I was thinking that one potential game changer is Joe Root's bowling. If Root bowls a lot, then you don't need Livingston and Moeen. You need Livingston or Moeen. Then you can put Butler at six, and then you can play all the batters that we were trying to squeeze into one team earlier.
Yeah,
and Harry, that just sounds like a better team, doesn't it?
Harry Brooks got Kane Williams in his back pocket as well. Can I just say one more thing on the, I found the thing about Billings and Milan really interesting, basically, because as you say, Milan's just basically played three series, got 300s in the team. Billings, I can imagine him looking at that thing like, hang on, this at one point this looked like my position to lose. What's happened here? Like at the end of 2020, he was brilliant in that Australia series that England lost. Made an amazing 100, made a 50 to end the series. He's had five ODI knocks since then, one of which was a very good 70 in that Australia series just gone. And yet he's kind of sort of on the fringes of the conversation, not even on the fringes of the squad, really, having averaged, I think, 50, striking at about 90 since the last World Cup. And it just shows how in a way, how fickle and strange cricket can be and how fickle and strange the calendar can be. And also how difficult it is to make choices in the cricketing world as it is, basically. Like, I wonder if Billings is looking at having chosen to play the PSL over the Bangladesh series. He gave an interesting interview to Crick Info, talking about his choice of that, saying that he's sat on the bench a lot, and that's been a theme through the interviews. He gave an interview to Joe a while ago, saying that he's 28-year-old, but feeling like he's played a 24-year-old amount of cricket, kind of thing. That he has just done a lot of time carrying drinks. He doesn't want to do that. Equally, I think if he goes to Bangladesh, I think he plays that series probably ahead of Vince, and then who knows what he might have done and where he might now be, because, you know, with Milan, it's only 9 games. It's kind of, you know, got him into the position he is now. I guess the one thing he'll look at is he's the same age now that Milan was ahead of the 2019 World Cup. So there's nothing stopping him from having a similar sort of run and being involved for 2027. Nothing can still happen. The final thing on Milan is just that I'm really happy for him as well, just because of how the T20 World Cup ended for him. Like, that was so much of his career was geared towards that, you know, his position in the T20 side. He was supposed to come to Australia, those flat tracks, dominate, didn't quite go for him with the bat, and then he gets the injury in it. It's such a minor injury as well. You'd almost feel better if it was like a, not better if it was a bad injury, but the timing just felt so cruel that you get just like the minor tweak that keeps you up for literally just 3 days, basically, because he then plays the first ODI after that World Cup. And so from a personal point of view, felt ready for him then. And so if he gets another chance to have his World Cup moment, which I think his career deserves, having basically been one of England's top 10 batters in all three formats for about 10 years, but that never quite being enough him to be in a first choice side for a long period of time and be absolutely established in any of those.
Yeah, and just going back to Milan and Billings is an interesting comparison. I think it's crucial to mention that Milan's got a central contract. He's not one of the full contracts, but that makes it a simpler decision, I guess.
Could I just add on Billings as well? I sort of agree with Ben that I think if we can assume that Stokes, well, let's imagine that Stokes isn't going to feature. So then you look at the, I agree that I think we need one more top six batter in there. I think his Billings versatility probably makes him the slight favourite for me, ahead of a Hales, ahead of a Vince, ahead of a Salt. I think he can play different versions of different roles. You know, he can go up top if needs be. He has experience against the white new ball, where he began at Kent. And obviously, he's a good finisher in there as well. He runs hard between the wickets. He's a useful reserve keeper, et cetera, et cetera.
And as a sub-fielder.
Yeah. And also, you know, that weird little intangible, that good in the dressing room thing, you know, they like him with good reason, you know. So I wouldn't be surprised if Stokes isn't in the frame, then he might get one of those last couple of places.
That interview he did is really interesting. He also talks about how he has turned down a lucrative IPL deal to play for Kent in the County Championship. He's really enjoyed his initial taste of Test cricket. I think he's played 3 Test matches now. And he sees that there's a potential avenue to get back in the squad at least by scoring loads of runs in April for Kent. So kind of fair play to him and all that. He's got a lot of stick unfairly for how he's prioritised various competitions in the past.
Right.
And now he's playing for Kent over KKR.
Well, as you know, we did a captain's round table on Zoom the other week, and we had 4 county captains, one of which was Sam Billings, and he called in from Pakistan at midnight in his hotel room. If anybody's labouring under the misapprehension that he doesn't care too much about county cricket or domestic cricket or even English cricket because he can earn money around the world, it's dispelled within seconds of this conversation. I mean, this is a bloke who is the archetype of the cricket obsessive and thinks about every little detail of English cricket, has views on the carve-up of the domestic system, the structure, the itinerary, pitches, grounds, dressing room culture, all of it. He has opinions on all of it, and they're all very well thought through, and they come from a place of real love. So, you know, that perception is wrong when it comes to him.
Ben, just finally on this series, how do we think Bangladesh are looking ahead of the World Cup? England got well and truly Shakibed in the final game. He's still quite good. He scored 75 and then took a 4 for. In those conditions, this is probably Bangladesh's best bet of getting to a World Cup semi-final.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, I wouldn't say that they are favourites for one of those top 4 spots, but I imagine they will be in and around the mix, as will lots of teams, to be honest. I think it being in India makes it a bit of a leveller in a way, in that, you know, Sri Lanka might well fancy having a decent chance. See, Pakistan will be one of the favourites for that semi-final spot. And then you look at Australia, New Zealand, England and India. Like, you've got quite a lot of teams there who will push for it. And Afghanistan will no doubt trouble a few teams as well. So I think it'll be really good. But Bangladesh, they've got, as I say, I don't think they showed the best of themselves in this series. They've got some really good batters in the likes of Litton Das. Shakib is obviously Shakib and is amazing. They've got you know, the fizz when he's on his day is very hard to play. I think they'll be pretty good.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
With the start of the cricket season arriving in only a matter of weeks and our lovely English weather being less than ideal at the moment, it's only fair that the Wisden shop is giving away a free limited edition Wisden cricket sweater worth £95. All you must do to enter the giveaway competition is to visit the link in this episode's description and answer some cricket related questions. Entries close on Monday the 13th of March, so don't miss your chance to enter. Australia won the third test in India to keep that series just about alive. It was a comprehensive 9-wicket win in Indore. The pitch was rated poor by the ICC. Very, very few pitches are given that rating. There was considerable turn from the first morning, but perhaps most concerningly in the eyes of the ICC, there was inconsistent bounce from that first morning as well. Matt Kuhneman in his second test match took 5 for 16 in the first innings and Nathan Lyon took an 8 for in the second after a quiet first test. He's done really, really well. Phil, do you think Australia will view this series as almost a missed opportunity? It's a fragile India side. Australia got various decisions probably wrong in terms of not just selection but game plan in the first two test matches. It's just a vulnerable India side, and test matches go so quickly on those pitches. It doesn't actually take you having that good a period of play to suddenly be miles on top in a test match.
That they had that moment in the second test where India were 7 down and only halfway to Australia's first innings, and admittedly they're smallish scores. And then they ended up losing it no more than 24 hours later by 9 wickets or whatever it was. But they've definitely had their moments. You know, dropping Travis Head for the first test is a classic, one for the ages. Mm. But also, you said in your intro there, just keeping the series just about alive. The series is well alive.
But the Border Gavaskar trophy is gone.
Ah, but if you take a 2-2 in India when they've won 45 of in 52 or 53 games, whatever it was going into this series. If you take 2 games off India, that is an extraordinary achievement, really. And you're right, even if they were to nick that final test match, they would still be slightly narky with themselves, cranky at certain moments that they could have maybe executed a little bit better. There were certain sort of hinge moments that were peculiarly un-Australian. I mean, going back to that, we've spoken about it before, but that Pat Cummins spell on the first evening after they'd sort of scrambled to 180 or whatever it was, and then by the close, Sharma had already made his mark. So yeah, no doubt they will be frustrated. But if they can get out of it with 2-2, that's an extraordinary result, really. And of course, that win ensures their place in the WTC final here at the Oval in a few months' time.
In the snow.
You did say on the podcast about a couple of weeks ago that, you know, the crocuses are out and the blossoms on the trees and all of that. It's not, Yaz. We're still end of days out there.
Since then, England have lost a test match. Australia started winning a test match. So things have been going downhill.
But no, yeah, I think your reading of it's right, yeah. And certainly India have looked vulnerable. But then all teams are going to look vulnerable on pitches that are skewed dramatically and out of the favour of the batters. And it really does bring that conversation that we had the other week very much to bear now when you see Kohli getting 20s and 20s and 20s and you don't even really notice the scorecards anymore. If somebody gets up to 40, then you, oh, well played. This is not Test cricket as the great Indian players of the past have recognised. This is not the Test cricket that arguably a lot of people want to see inside and outside of India. And that third Test match was extreme. And I'm glad the ICC, I spoke to Wazim Khan, who's the ICC GM, hours before they released their official verdict on the pitch. And I asked him about the pitches, and he said that as an organisation, they are very aware of this, you know, and he made the case for Rawalpindi having been overturned back to adequate. And I didn't agree with him on it, but this is at least a conversation that
What was his case? That pitch was a disgrace.
Yeah, I'm not saying. It will come out in the wash. But this is, he recognises, as they do, that, you know, pitches are absolutely the bedrock, literally the bedrock of good, powerful, zestful, watchable test cricket. And what we saw at indoor was an inversion of all of that, really.
Yeah.
Can I just say, this is the first time I've actually cared about the World Test Championship and the final. Because if Australia do nick that last test match and Sri Lanka manage to beat New Zealand 2-0, mm-hmm. however unlikely that might be, India won't qualify for the final. And then there might be a conversation to be had, because it'll be the pitch's fault, right? If they prepare another rank turner in Ahmedabad and the match is over again in 2.5 days and India lose, then you can say that the pitch has lost India a place in that World Test Championship final. And I think that'll be a really interesting discussion to be had. And I'm sure it'll be very well-tempered and, you know, evenly discussed.
Well, let's have it now. I mean, Ben, you've done a bit of research on how pitches have changed in India over the last, 5 years?
Seven, really. Or eight. Shall I do the quick history lesson?
Go for it. I think you're going to do it anyway.
It goes all the way back to Kohli's first series as India captain at home, which was against South Africa. And this was the South Africa side that hadn't lost on the road since 2006 at that point, I think. So this is in 2015. And the series then turned a lot. There was this incredible partnership between de Villiers and Amla, where they both scored sort of a 250 ball 50s, which was great. But also, it was a miracle that they managed to last that long. And these pitches were kind of as bad as the ones in the last test. And one of them was rated poor. Kohli kind of fumed after that, kind of saying, like, you know, when we go to South Africa and we get skittled, people say, how bad are India at batting? When teams come here and they get skittled, they say, how bad are Indian pitches, kind of thing. So that was Kohli kind of laying down a marker, saying, like, you know, we're not going to take this kind of thing. We're going to make the most of home advantage. However, maybe in reaction to the poor rating, the next two series they played were on decent pitches, and India, you know, clean swept both of them, I think. Then Australia visited, and it was the same kind of thing as that South Africa series. But again, you had the first test, the pitch was rated poor, Australia won with the spinners doing the damage, and it was a bit of almost a lottery. And then even though the rest of the pitch in that series turned, probably wasn't turning as much. And after that, you had India build up this incredibly dominant home record, and also build up a cabal of quicks who could kind of threaten anywhere in the world on pitches that kind of rewarded all types of cricket. You could bat really big, the quicks would be in the game, spinners would come into it. You know, they've been in it on day one, they might win the game on day five.
Kohli would average 60 with the bat, Bumrah
exactly.
20 with the ball.
There was a game in indoor where the last test was played against Australia in 2019, where quicks took something like 28 of the 31 wickets to fall or something, and India made 400 and they smashed, okay, Bangladesh, but still by an innings. That was a mark of what happened. So what's changed since then is two things. One, England come and win on that sort of surface. And
was it, sorry, a flat pitch?
On a flat pitch, Root makes a double hundred. India can't get close and they lose the game. And I guess what you see there is how actually the toss can have quite a big impact on that sort of surface if the other team are capable of putting up a big total, because it means you can't really lose the game. And then actually it can be quite hard to save it because of what the pitch turns into later on. And then we know what the pitches were like for the rest of the England series. The other thing that happened was that New Zealand drew a test in Kanpur, where they drew it 9 wickets down the final day. And because of how the World Championship point system works, Rahul Dravid was talking about this yesterday, saying that you basically have to have results. Like, it's, you know, it's better to lose a series 2-1 than to draw it 0-0, I think, in terms of points for the World Test Championship. But that's the kind of equation that's at play. And those are the two things. One is that, and I guess the other sort of underlying thing is maybe India don't trust their batters quite as much on that kind of flatter surface. India used to think they could sort of out-bat other teams. Now they maybe don't think that, and they think, okay, we have to outspin them, so let's pick a pitch, let's have a pitch that allows us to outspin a team rather than out-bat a team. But now where do they go from here? Because, you know, would this Australia team beat India on a flatter track? Maybe. Would they outbowl India on a seeming track? Maybe. And would a spinning track be a lottery as the third test was? Almost certainly. So I think that the pitch for the fourth test will be fascinating, and also going forward, seeing how India choose to react to this in terms of the pitches will also be interesting, I think.
They must have been embarrassed, right, really? And the big hitters, Sharma, Dravid, Kohli, they must have been... And yet, the question is, how much control do they have? How much influence do they have? That's always been the assumption, right, that these huge icon figures lean down upon the curator and say, this is what we need. But I think the reality might be a little bit more complex than that, really, because you can't imagine a world where Sharma, who is a legacy player, or Kohli, who is an all-timer, or Dravid, whose heart beats for the game and who's very dignified and got great integrity, I can't imagine that they would have been at ease with this situation at all, right?
But Rohit Sharma, didn't he say before they lost that third test, he said something like, oh, you know, if we win the next one, we might prepare a green seamer in Ahmedabad. And I don't know how much of that's bluster, but, you know, it certainly gives the impression that they at least have a say in the preparation of these pitches. But you would be fuming, right? You'd be right. Fuming that you can't score tons in that in a landmark home test series against what was billed beforehand as the best test side in the world, travelling to India, one that could actually unseat India's home dominance. You would be absolutely fuming.
Mm. Yeah, and exactly. And I think if you end up with a pitch as mucky as that last one, then it does make it almost a lottery. You know, Australia have got some half-decent finger spinners. India have obviously got some great finger spinners, but you are reducing the margins to such an extent that it is almost, you're blindfolded and just chucking darts at the board and seeing who ends up with the result at the end of it. And that played out. That's what happened. So that strategically doesn't really add up, is what I'm saying.
Well, India have lost three tests at home on the last decade, and two of them have been rated poor because they didn't allow for a balance between bat and ball, i.e. like, even if you're really good at batting, you might just get out, and even if you're not that great at bowling, you might just get some wickets.
And was the other game the Ahmedabad third test match?
No, it was the one that Australia won in 2017.
Oh, yeah, the Pune game. Yeah. Yes.
I completely agree with what you're saying on the pitch. I do think the Australia spinners deserve quite a lot of credit, because when it turns that much, it's actually quite hard to take wickets. You have to be quite clever with your angles. And Lyon, I thought, it was brilliant in the second innings, bowling around the wicket to right-handers. And I've said it on the bubble before, but I just don't understand why off-spinners don't bowl around the wicket as default. LBW's more in play, etc. But Kuhneman is, I think his nickname in state cricket is Jadeja, because he has quite a similar style of just kind of making subtle changes with his angle, bowling quite straight, bowling LBW into play. And Todd Murphy doesn't have quite as much action on the ball as Lyon does, but he doesn't go for anything. So as a trio, Australia have landed on a spin trio that works quite well together. It complements each other quite well, even though I don't think they planned that to be the case before the start of the series.
Yeah, and we should give Australia quite a lot of credit here. I mean, I know Katty said if India don't make the World Championship final, it'll be because of the pitches, and I think Australia might think that they had something to do with it as well, I guess. And yeah, Lyon was brilliant, and I think the fact that it had inconsistent bounce also brought him into the game more, because bounce is often one of his weapons. So if it's inconsistent, that can make it actually even more of a threat. Khawaja batted absolutely brilliantly in the first innings, made, 64, but that's worth, you know, 100, 150 on a normal test wicket. And Travis Head, so for that final morning, I didn't mean to get up, but I found myself up early and then was like, well, India have taken a wicket with the second ball of the day, so I should probably watch this. And for quite a while in that chase, thought that Australia might well mess this up. It felt actually a lot like
Abu Dhabi.
Exactly, yeah. Where it was like, hang on, if Australia are going to chase this, they're going to need 30, 35 overs at the rate that they're going, and India are going to create a lot of chances in that time. And then all of a sudden, it was basically done, because Head just flicks a switch, starts sort of hitting the spinners around the park, and the game is done inside the first hour, really. He played really, really well. Obviously, it makes it even more incredible they didn't pick him for that first test, because he's looked one of their best players since then. And I guess there'll also be a question over, I mean, he did it opening the batting, and I imagine he'll open in the next test as well. And what will happen when David Warner recovers from that elbow injury, if Head will have made that spot his own, or if they'll just go back to Warner opening with Khawaja, and that top six they would have had inked in for the Ashes ahead of this series, I guess.
Bit of news on the final test match. Pat Cummins will remain in Australia to be with his family for the final test. So Steve Smith will once more captain Australia in the final game. The Women's Premier League started over the weekend. We've had 5 matches at the time of recording, 3 team scores of 200 or more. We've had standout performances from familiar names. Harmanpreet Kaur hit 65 off 30 in the first game. Shefali Verma scored a rapid 84 as well. But also some standout performances from names we might not have heard a lot about before. USA left-arm seamer Tara Norris, who plays her domestic cricket in the UK, took the first ever WPL fifer. The left-arm spinner at Mumbai, Saika Ishak, who's not played for India yet, looks very good. She took 4 for 11 in the opening game. Katya, what have you made of the tournament so far?
Yeah, well, it's been good, hasn't it? I think that there have been lots of big scores, lots of 200-plus scores, and that's a great spectacle. But I'm sceptical how long that continues if the games aren't competitive, because there's been very few close games, right? So it's great watching teams smash over 100. It's great from an Indian audience perspective with Harmanpreet Kaur, as you say, whacking it in the first game. But 200 and whatever plays 64 all out, as it was in the first game, when you take the competition away, that kind of 200 plus score becomes quite, not dull, but quite disengaging quite quickly. So it's been a really good start, but it would be nice to see some more competitive games of cricket as kind of my takeaway from the first few days of the competition been, albeit having only giving it a few days to settle down and now criticising it. But yeah.
I do wonder if it is going to take time for analysts to work out how best to, which players to target and which players to value most highly in auctions. It's a new pool of players. We don't know quite how good the domestic players are. We don't know how good the reserves are in Indian batting, seam bowling, spin bowling. So I can see it taking a while to get to a point where the teams are quite even. I mean, you still see it in men's franchise competitions that have been around for a decade, that there's still massive mismatches. So it's quite a hard thing to get right.
Yeah, well, it's like you say, one of the best things about franchise cricket as it's been is discovering someone who's completely unknown and is just absolutely brilliant. And adding that to the WPL, once it's kind of settled down a little bit, that'll be probably the most compelling element of competition, because it's like you said, we all are familiar with these names who are brilliant, like Nat Sivabrant, who got 50 off not very much the other day, and Harmanpreet Kaur and Alyssa Healy and all the rest. But the really interesting part of it is going to be finding someone from the domestic scene like Tara Norris, who no one knows really, who comes and does something incredible. And that'll be the main attraction, or not the main attraction, but that'll be one of the best things about the competition, because we've been wanting that pathway for so many years, and that kind of stage does offer that.
Just, I wanted to make a point on the Tara Norris thing, which I think is quite interesting from a few points of view. One is about her future, because she's very skillful, she's very talented. I'd wonder if she'd ever be good enough to be established first choice for England. And she has ambitions to play for England. I think she said to you on the podcast a few years ago, actually, that so she plays for USA, but that doesn't affect her eligibility for England. So that could happen. But now, when that chance maybe comes, I think she might be good enough to play a couple of games. And obviously, that's how you maybe get into being first choice. But if she plays for England even once, that would sort of close off this door to her as getting this sort of, this fee each year. I also think that franchises might be looking at her success and thinking they missed a bit of a trick, basically, that there are other associate players around the world who you'd think would be a better bet than the weakest domestic player in that squad, the likes of the Brises from Scotland or Sterk Ellis from the Netherlands some of Thailand's players. You wonder if they might actually look next year to bring in that as well. And then the other thing as well is, if you're an English player at like a sort of maybe a mid-level regional player, even on the fringes of the 100, whether you should be looking around the family tree to see if you've got any sort of Scottish or German or whatever ancestry, go and play in a qualifier, and then you've actually got a decent route into the biggest show in town, basically, which I think would be great for associate cricket. Obviously, the end goal is to have pathways that produce their own talent that don't have to go looking to other systems and getting these things, but a route to getting the funding that allows you to do that is to have a team good enough to make an impact at a qualifying event. And that's what some of these players can do. I mean, Tara Norris bowled really well to get USA to the global qualifier. I know they didn't territories there, and Norris wasn't available for that. But that's the kind of thing that can open up some funding and that sort of thing.
But just on that associate nation point, they introduced that rule in the WPL, right? I think from my understanding of it, you can have an extra overseas player if that player is from an associate nation. But it doesn't seem like that's kind of gone far enough to get associate players into it. Like the gap between associate nations and full member nations is less in my opinion, than in women's cricket than it is in men's cricket. You know, you had Nepal beating, was it Pakistan in the Women's Asia Cup last year? And I don't think there are any Nepalese players in the WPL. I'm not entirely sure on that.
No, Tara Norris is the only associate player that was picked up. And actually, there was confusion at the auction over that rule. One of the franchises tried to pick up another US player, but they thought it was you could have an extra overseas player in the squad if they're an associate, when it's just in the 11 that counts. So that's the other thing, is that you do lose a squad space, I suppose, but still. In the tournament, I've really enjoyed it. There's been some questions over the boundary sizes and therefore the high scores. I haven't minded that too much. I think it is good for making a bit of a splash to see, like, I do think sixes being hit is quite fun. And I the close games thing is an issue, and you're more likely to get close games if you have lower totals, I suppose. But I've enjoyed it. I've also enjoyed some of the reviewing of wides. I think that has the potential for some quite funny things to happen, as well as it probably being a good move overall. I think it's been good. I think it's been entertaining. I don't think they could have hoped for much more in terms of, you know, all the players you'd want to make runs would have made runs. Grace Harris was quite unlucky, wasn't she? She plays that brilliant innings in the first game. What did they chase? Was it 70 runs in the last five over, something like that? And she drove the bulk of that, and then she was left out for the second game, which is a bit unlucky. But yeah.
Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully, with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Over the last week or so, the Cricket Discipline Commission hearing on the Yorkshire racism scandal has taken place. 2.5 years on from Azeem Rafiq's initial claims, the focus was essentially on whether or not Vaughan made the comment, "There are too many of you lot to four players of Asian descent," before a T20 game in 2009. Katia, with all that's gone on over the last 2.5 years, we've ended up with the focus on one comment that may or may not have happened 14 years ago. How has that happened?
Michael Vaughan's the only one who's chosen to give evidence in his defence at the hearing. So Yorkshire and Yorkshire Cricket, County Cricket Club as a whole have admitted the charges against them and decided not to give evidence in defence at the hearing. So is Gary Balance has admitted the charges the ECB have brought against him and decided not to take part in the hearing. And the rest of them, so Tim Bresnan, Andrew Gale and the others, have decided not to participate in the hearing because they don't think they'll get a fair hearing. It is disappointing, I guess, that it's all turned into a dispute over one comment rather than the structural change and the deep change that needs to happen in light of these allegations. It seems quite a superficial way to end the process, even though it's not an ending. It's billed as the ending to the specific allegations that Rafiq has made. So it just feels inherently dissatisfying, I guess, that this is what it's come down to over the one comment, like you said.
The CDC normally adjudicate on less serious matters behind closed doors, and we have this like slightly bizarre situation where the public focus, I mean, this is getting so much public attention. This was on BBC News of the day, where the public focus is on one comment where one of the people alleging that the comment was made says they saw it as just a bad joke at the time, and then the person who says they haven't made the comment is saying that it's an abhorrent thing to say, whilst also admitting that they have tweeted things that they admit they have tweeted that are really bad. Ben, what do you make of it? There has been some stuff on the ECB process at various points. It isn't just on whether or not so-and-so said whatever.
There's an element of me that wonders whether it has been helpful that this is public or not, that there's kind of just it's a lot of it feels like running over old ground, and just I think the thing with the ECB investigation is that this was when Mina Boutros, who's the ECB's head of legal, I think, was quizzed on the investigation, who they asked, who they hadn't asked. It turned out they hadn't asked the umpires, they hadn't been able to get in touch with all of the players at the game, they hadn't asked this guy cameraman who was there, which I suppose on one face seems like a bit of a, you could even say, you know, a dereliction, like it, they haven't gone to, you know, the extreme length they could have. Equally, when you look at, you know, the extent of all the charges, this is one of the more minor ones, and this isn't an organisation with, you know, limitless pockets that can, you know, spend ages and ages querying every detail, because also this is such a thing that's just not fit for purpose to investigate, if you know what I mean. Like, this, as you say, this isn't what the CDC was really set up to do, or at least it's one of many things that falls under its remit, and I can't imagine it was foreseen or predicted when, you know, when it was created that it would have to look into something of this scale. So I don't know if I have sympathy for the ECB exactly, because if you're the sports governing body, these are the kind of tricky situations that you will have to deal with occasionally. But yeah, I guess the thing is that this won't be any sort of ending. Like, I imagine, well, that there may well be appeals as well after it, for one thing, but also that in some ways, I guess it's necessary that you have to delve into individual things, as much as a lot of the talk has been, you know, this is about structures, this is about a culture. That doesn't absolve people of individual things that they've done, and those do need to be investigated as well. And, you know, if it would be much worse if there was no sort of way to look into, you know, allegations of racism and to come up with, you know, judgments of guilty or not guilty, because, you know, this won't be the last CDC hearing on racism, I guess, unless they decide that there's another way of going forward altogether. But this is not the thing that should be focused on when, you know, well, the whole saga, maybe it won't sort of ever really end or conclude. But if you're looking at it right now, thinking like, what have we learned from, you know, the stuff that Azim has said, from the stuff that other players have said about the stuff that's happened at Yorkshire, at other counties, it should not focus on whether Michael Vaughan said this one thing or not, and should focus on the totality of how cricket views itself, how cricket is welcoming to those who, you know, aren't white and, you know, don't have, you know, lots of money as well, and that sort of thing. That would be the better thing to focus on than to, yeah, the details of 14 years ago, even though there is a certain necessity in going back over it, just because individual responsibility is part of this too, I guess.
I think it's worth saying that the CDC are deciding this on the balance of probabilities rather than the higher legal standard of beyond reasonable doubt.
It's a show trial, right? This is increasingly how it feels, and you two are bang on. I couldn't agree more that these structural institutional reckonings that the game is slowly going through have been reduced to what was said when, and I don't want to denigrate the significance of those words, but this has become about a former England captain, which is one of the reasons why it is so far up the news, because it's an easy, juicy thing for the press to get their teeth into. But the real story is what happens imminently when the final report comes out from the Independent Commission for Equity in Cricket. And now, this has been a report that's been prepared for a year and a half now. Cindy Butts, who has been, she's the chair and she's been overseeing it. She was speaking in March last year. Already 4,000 people inside the game had reported their own experiences of discrimination. And this was a year ago. Well, yeah, literally a year ago. Over 4,000 at that point. We're still waiting for the final report to be dropped, and it will be imminent. It was due to be early this year. We're moving in further into the year, but it will be imminent. And when it does, the ugly and tawdry and very regrettable contents of this particular investigation or inquiry, they get moved well to the side, because they are nothing compared to the scale of what we are as a game going to have to confront in due course. And it seems like the Vaughan saga is a mere microcosm of the broader and bigger stories. There is also another unfortunate irony here in that Azim Rafiq, right from the start, and people will disagree with this, but it's my personal view that I believed him when he said he didn't want this to be about personalities. He didn't want this to be about individuals. And yet it's become that now, or in this instance, it's become that. But his point, Rafiq, it seemed to me, and he was consistent on this, has always been about structural institutional discrimination and problems. This is not about the sort of the muckraking of who said what when, he said, she said stuff. This is about something more, far more structural than that. And it's a sort of, it's an unfortunate irony that this last week or so has ended up revolving around one person, effectively one person, when the story is obviously so much vaster than that.
Yeah, there's not been as much public scrutiny on the structural questions. I remember we talked about it late last year when there was the second DCMS hearing and the MPs didn't really know what they were talking about, to be honest. They hadn't done their research. That there wasn't that much scrutiny on the governing bodies concerned, really. And that felt like a missed opportunity. I think the big questions that pretty much everyone involved has wanted to keep at the forefront of the discussion hasn't actually had the public forum for scrutiny in the way I think we assumed would happen.
But I think this report will answer that.
Mm.
I think it will be unavoidable, the findings, because from what we gather and from what we already know from Cindy Butts, I mean, she said a year ago, all is not well with the game and it faces a reckoning. They're quotes straight from her. And we know the numbers, as I've just said. So when this report finally lands, I think all of the tentacles of the story that have been running for the last 2 years, they all get wound up into this overriding headline. And it won't make good reading because many thousands of people have felt excluded from the game.
Mm.
And this is what this report will tell us.
Moving on, I've been quite distracted during this pod because on our screen, we've had Aidan Markram batting. I think he's just got out.
Did you see how he got out?
I did.
No.
Oh, it's like, batting like a dream. Spinner comes on, plays a little weird scoop, sweep, lobs up.
And Blackwood runs around from first
slip.
From slip
and sort of juggles and gets a dolly. Oh, what is he doing?
And he doesn't get his 100.
No, that's the Aidan Markram career in microcosm, isn't it?
Mm.
Cricket's difficult though.
Katia, his 100 last week was your moment of the week.
Yeah, well, I feel cheated of that innings because I can't see past Phil's laptop really. So. really enjoyed his 100. He's had a difficult couple of years, I think it's fair to say, with Test cricket. And then had a really, really good week last week, not only because of the Test 100, but he's now T20 captain for South Africa as well. It was brilliant. And as we've said, he's so, so good to watch when he gets going, and his cover drive rivals everyone in the game. And as we know, having a good cover drive is everything in cricket. You mentioned Dawid Malan as an enigma earlier on. I feel like Markram kind of fits under a similar category. Ever since he captained that under-19 South Africa side to win the World Cup, he's been billed as South Africa's saviour and, you know, South Africa's answer to the big four, and never really delivered on that promise. I think he was run out by Dean Elgar in his first test match on 97, and then scored 100 in his second test match, at which point he was, you know, the second coming pretty much and South Africa's saviour, as I've already said. But when he came to England last year, he hadn't scored he'd scored one century, I think, since 2018. And I think it's a fairly common thought that he's been given too much responsibility and borne that burden too early. I think when he captained that ODI series in South Africa against Australia and against India in 2018, the stat was that he'd got two ODI caps and the rest of the side had over 800 between them. But he was dropped down to three when they went to New Zealand, I think beginning of 2022, didn't score any runs, dropped down to four in England, didn't score any runs in the first two tests, and then was dropped for the match here at the Oval. I think it's hard to argue, not deservedly so. He hadn't scored any runs, and that is what it's all about. But really, it did him a favour because it meant he didn't go to Australia, where no one in South Africa's side scored runs. But new captain, new coach, test side, and he's back and he scores 100. So it's a bit of a fairy tale stuff at his home ground as well. Looked good while doing it. Great week, lovely stuff. I think the thing is about him, of all of South Africa's problems, I think he's quite low down on the list. And it's hard to argue that he shouldn't have been dropped, but when he's scoring runs, there's very few better. And South Africa have a lot else to look at other than Aidan Markram doesn't score a century for a while.
Some of it flows as well from what happened in their T20 tournament. Because you're bang on. I mean, he had a stinker of a year. He had a stinker of maybe 3 years. But he came into that tournament as the skipper of the Orange team, whichever one they were called, the Sunrisers, the something Sunrisers or other, and played really well, made a brilliant 100, I think, in the semi-final of it, maybe, yeah. And then made a few, I think, in the final as well. But either way, he was playing really well. And that 100, they were 10 for 2, 8 for 2, I think they were. And then he made a brilliant 50-odd ball 100. And I remember watching that live, and he was almost in tears when he made the runs, because it was one of those cathartic moments that you get in cricket in particular, when finally you have a day where you can enjoy yourself. Finally, you can have a day where you can just sleep 8 hours at the end of it. And I think a lot of what you've seen since has sort of flowed from that, really. I think that tournament sort of liberated him and put him back in the centre stage of South African cricket. And now you're seeing, as Kasia says, I mean, you know, when he's in form, he's a great player to watch. We've been saying for years, right, on Markram, he's the best bad player in the world, right? And I ask you all the time, has he got any runs yet? And finally, he is.
He's also going to be captain of the Orange team in the IPL as well. He's going to be Sunrisers.
So he was under 19s captain in South Africa as well. Mm. Bright bloke, well educated, etc. So that's why they've always thrown a lot onto his shoulders. But you've got to score runs at the same time, and he's still what, only probably 25, 26.
So. No, he's 28. That's
is kind he really?
Of, yeah, that's oh, kind right. of part of it. Is
I think that's the thing,
he's,
yeah.
He's is not that young anymore.
They had stuck with him for so long, and obviously we can all see the talent, and there was a sense that he was worth sticking with. And
you'd
yet,
have dropped him 1,000 times ago, wouldn't
no,
you?
No, yeah, I mean, I
strung him up.
But I think he also becomes especially important because this is a South Africa set up in a certain amount of flux, as Kasia alluded to, with two new coaches, right, for the various formats, and apart from, I know they won the first test handsomely, but it feels like there's some odd stuff going on basically, and the new coach is finding their feet, finding what the best team they have is. They made four changes from that game, only one of which was enforced by the injury to Anrik Nortje. So they have dropped Keegan Petersen, who you like, Phil, but they've picked Ryan Rickleton, who you also like. So
I don't particularly like Keegan Petersen.
Oh, do you not?
No.
Okay. All right. No, Phil hates Keegan Petersen exclusively.
No, I didn't. I thought it was asking a lot of him to bat three in England, and I said that at the time. I know he played okay against India.
You like? We all like. I
like to watch him. You want to go back through the shows? I thought it was a big ask for him to bat three in England, and so it proved.
So the new coach has dropped him one game into the new regime. Picked Ryan Rickleton. They've also, having picked centre
as a batter, just as a straightforward batter.
Who's that?
Rickleton.
Yes.
Yeah, because obviously he keeps as well.
Yeah, but they've still got Clarkson playing this game, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
They've also, so they had Sinner and Muthusamy as their only spinner in the last test. He's a bit of an all-rounder, but they've left him out and picked two spinners. So he's now not in their best two spinners, having sort of been their best spinner last week. Maharaj and Harmer's come back in. Maharaj wasn't in the side last week. They've also either rested or dropped Jansen and picked Wiaan Mulder instead. So maybe they're just seeing this as a bit of a free hit. Let's do some fact-finding.
There is no way they've picked Wiaan Mulder over Mark
well,
Jansen.
Yeah, but
there is no way.
But then, you know,
Don't try and logic it. I think just last thing on Markram, it's not that he scored a century and a 50 and now everything's rosy. He averages 22 away from home. Mm. There's still significant questions for him to answer, but he's at least bought himself some time at the top of that South Africa lineup. Mm. And it's also worth noting that him and Dean Elgar have quite a good relationship. They've played domestic cricket together. Dean Elgar has spoken highly of him a lot, and has said openly that he enjoys batting with Markram. So there's something to be said for also keeping Dean Elgar happy and having a harmonious opening partnership, I guess.
Ben, finally, your moment of the week. Shaheen Afridi batting 6. What the hell's going on there?
I saw he wrote about this. Wrote a whole article on this.
Just a little short one. But yeah, I mean, it was fun. I mean, he's
done it twice in the second time he got 50.
Yeah.
You better write another one.
Well, no, that was after I wrote it. But yeah, so
that's what I mean.
So what's going on here? So Both times.
That's what I'm trying to ask you.
But both times, his side, Lahore Calanders, were four down inside the power play. So it's a specific situation in which he is promoting himself. I think if you look at the scorecards, you'd think he is kind of almost like a pinch blocker. Like he's coming up to see out a difficult period of bowling to save innings for the later end. Yesterday, he was 1 off 9 at one point, and the first game he was 16 off 16. If you actually watched it, he's kind of swinging off his feet every ball. And it was just he happened to be missing them quite a lot. And then yesterday, after he had his iron, he batted really, really well, went to a 50. I think he went from 1 to 50 off like 25, 26 balls, I think, and hit 5-6 in the end of his innings. But like it was a decent innings. You'd look and say that they lost the game and lost it reasonably comfortably in the end, but they're chasing over 200 most of the times. If you're four down the power play chasing 200, you lose. They actually kind of almost got close and they had any right to. By the time Razzit is brilliant in the death, I think that's the main thing, is they're trying to preserve him for that phase. And he did play very well, and they needed, what, 40 odd off the last 13, which is just about doable, and you take it if you're four down the power play chasing over 200.
And Roz had, I think, went 10 off 3 straight away.
Exactly, so, yeah. So and then the first game, they were four down. Raza came in a bit later, made 70 or 34. He was the hero of the game, but they won that. Again, you don't often win games when you're four in the power play. So I quite like it as a move. And he's captained quite well. I mean, that team is top of the table. And then the other good thing the PSL has been is Islamabad United, and who've got a habit of chasing big scores in quite exciting ways. Azam Khan has had a very good season. He's a really fun player to watch. He's the son of Moeen Khan, former Pakistan wicketkeeper batter, and he plays a sweep shot off the quicks that's exactly like Moeen Khan used to play, except almost better, because he can do it to sort of these wide Yorkers that you just sort of, just a little flick and it's off over square leg. There was a wide Yorker in their win yesterday, which was dealt with in a different fashion. Did you see this, Phil? I imagine you didn't.
I did see it.
You did see it, yeah.
Was it you lot who stuck it on the Twitters?
Yeah, yeah.
So that six over sort of fine third.
Yeah.
And he's only gone to do it at the very last second, twisted the bat in his hands.
This was Fahim Ashraf, yeah.
Sorry?
Fahim Ashraf did this, yeah.
That was an all-time freak shot.
Yeah.
I literally don't think I've seen a shot quite like that.
The only thing about it you're going to say, it was entirely telegraphed what was going to happen. So the ball before, so the first ball was way wide, and if it actually pitched before it had reached the crease, it would have been a no ball, but because it didn't, it was just a wide. Then the next ball was a very, very good wide Yorker that he goes sort of lap into the leg side, gets an under edge that goes for four, and then you see Mohammad Rizwan say very, very clearly, like, don't worry, that was the right ball, do the same thing again. So Fahim Ashraf's like, oh, okay, I think I know what's going to happen here. Sets himself for it and just, yeah, the little flick over. So
the execution was excellent.
Yeah, they won that game.
The one thing that's quite funny about Afridi, this PSL is his first cricket tournament since he got married to the daughter of Shahid Afridi. So he's really taking on the family responsibility of being a middle order. Yeah. Biffer.
No wedding night advice, but saying, look, son, you got to bat six and you got to hit some sixes if you want to be a true member of the Afridi clan.
And on that note, that is all we have time for on today's show. Cheers, Cathy. Cheers, Phil. Cheers, Ben. This has been the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. We'll be back next week.
Podcast Network.